Questions about anything? So, we've reached pretty much the end of the class. We've scheduled a help session for tomorrow here at 4 p.m. Final has been scheduled for a long time, Thursday at 6 p.m. What we decided last time is to have an alternative time where people would show up at my office at 2. That's kind of in the middle of an exam period, and somebody has suggested that 3 might be a better start time. Questions or comments? 3 is, 2, which is better?
2 is better.
So who's for 2? 4. Who's for 3? I see 3 for 3. And so I think the solution is come at 2 or 3. Doesn't make a big difference. Don't come at 4. I hope, actually, I'd probably be here at 4 anyway, but 2 or 3. Just come in there we'll find a place to take it. Probably take it in a lab so it won't be as comfortable as being in a room, but I think it'll all work out okay. So in terms of, so you should all have a really good idea of what your grade is numerically, and I don't know, maybe half dozen of you have taken the advantage of emailing me and asking me a question like, what do I need to get on the final in order to get grade X? And I'm quite happy to answer those sorts of questions. Your final counts like 1/3 of your grade, and so it can shift things a little bit. It can probably move you half a grade from your current location, but it's probably not going to make a huge effect for most people. And even a lesser effect is the post-test, but that's the last thing that goes into the homework quiz lab category. And I don't know, maybe half a dozen of you have taken the post-test already. Best way to study for the exam, there isn't a final, no, there isn't an old final that's online, but there are your old exams are probably the best place to start. So that misses two topics. It misses life and it misses the sun. If you look at the old 211 exams, and for that matter, some of the exam 2 for 212, you can see the sorts of questions that occurred for the sun. The life, I think, probably the best way of studying it is to go over the chapter in the book. So it'll be proportionately longer. So I take the proportion of time and kind of round it to fives. And I think that maybe ends up with something like 35 true and false, and maybe, I forget the numbers, but I literally calculated out proportional to the time, and otherwise it's the same format, basically the same fraction of true false and short answer and longer answer questions. And in terms of kind of the big questions, they're not so the big questions, I mean like the culmination problem from the first exam and then identifying constellation and stars from exams 2 and 3. I mean they're likely candidates for those 7 or so 10-point questions on the exam. And I guess I don't guarantee it, but it's awfully tempting to use the winter hexagon as the identify stars one, because it kind of hits constellations and stars at the same time. Other questions? So we're working on our last ology, our biology. And we only have one example of biology, maybe unfortunately, and that's life on Earth. And it's hard to know exactly how seriously we should take that. That is to say, is it typical or not? Is it one of a kind? So one kind of obvious problem with evolution in general is kind of chicken and egg sorts of problems, where it seems like two things are required, and it's hard to see how one of them would come about without the other one coming about. And maybe the first chicken and egg problem among many is this odd relationship between where the information is stored in order to blueprint out the construction of life, that's DNA, and the material itself, the protein that's in order that you need in order to make cells. So protein is, DNA is required to make protein. It has the code, but on the other hand, protein is required to copy DNA. So which came first? There isn't any really happy solution to how the very, very first forms of life would arrive. And in some sense, people really haven't advanced beyond Darwin's speculations of 150 years ago. But one possibility that's a little bit interesting is sometimes called the RNA world. So RNA has this kind of funny role in biology. It's not really clear why it's required. So DNA is transcribed into RNA, and then RNA is translated, the three-letter codes are translated into proteins. And you kind of wonder why, what's RNA doing there? And one possible answer comes up with the fact that strands of RNA can do a lot of the same things that proteins can do. In particular, they can catalyze chemical reactions. And that's the property of enzymes, and it's really a key characteristic of proteins. And so we have some segments of RNA which can act as enzymes. So speculation is that maybe you could imagine first biological organisms just having RNA, and then evolving from then to invent better sorts of enzymes in the form of proteins, and then evolving better forms of information storage in the form of DNA, kind of a middle solution. If we trace back the tree of life as far as we can, this is kind of the story we get. And the first kind of important take on all of this is that multicellular creatures are really small change. Microbiology really is 99.99% of biology. But what we've got here are bacteria and things that probably would look a lot like bacteria, but if you look on the insides, they actually have a fair amount of commonality with the eukaryotes. The eukaryotes are the organisms that have nuclei inside their cells. So bacteria certainly have DNA, but the DNA isn't organized into a separate membraned compartment. And they have lots of simpler action. The way the information is stored on the DNA is a lot simpler than it is on eukaryotes. But in any case, these guys have a certain amount of similarity with the eukaryotes, not including a nucleus, but other sorts of biochemical similarities. They also have connections to bacteria, so they're kind of an interesting intermediate stage. They also tend to include lots of kind of unusual bacteria, bacteria that love methane, bacteria that love highly salty environments. These things kind of, the name actually suggests these things are kind of ancient versions of early forms of life. And you can see that, I don't know, in this particular branching, this separation between the early bacteria and the early archaea are the origin of the of life. Okay, so all of that seemed to have happened in a relatively short period of time, something like 100 million years. On the other hand, in order to get to more complicated organisms, it was a heavy slog. Pick out this one, I guess. So here we have formation of the Earth. For a long period of time, the Earth's surface was molten, so it wasn't a candidate for the origin of life. We get life going pretty quickly, and then we have this huge piece of time where, as far as we can figure out, there were just microorganisms present. One of the key features in this period of time, incidentally, of course, is the buildup of oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere. So these guys are producing crap, oxygen, bad stuff, a poison that is slowly building up in the environment, and they're going to kill each other's off unless they can find some use for this poison. And this process of surviving this nasty event where the poison becomes very common, roughly 2 billion years ago. So then in the fossil record, there's a sudden explosion of multicellular organisms. It's really hard to recognize microorganisms in rocks. I mean, is this a bubble or is this a once bacteria? A lot of this early evidence is based on the chemistry that's involved, the chemical differences between life and inorganic life. And of course, early on, the land was not habitable, so just life on land, you can see, is a small segment. And finally, we work our way up to mammals. But all of this stuff, mammals are just the very small tip of the iceberg in this sort of picture. Vast majority of time, just microorganisms living in the sea. So apparently, making multicellular organisms is a lot harder than making single-cell organisms, or at least it certainly took a lot of time. One of the ideas is that what you're made out of, cells that have subsections, organelles, like not like ribosomes, because all of them have ribosomes, but like mitochondria and nucleus and chloroplasts, that those things actually came about by a symbiosis, where we had, where what became a chloroplast was a previously free-running bacteria, which was then encased in another animal, and together those two things live on, in some sense, in plants. Okay, so the other thing we talked about is the Drake equation, and don't want to make too much out of the Drake equation. It's not, in any sense, science. It's more or less just the simple argument made numerical, that there are a lot of stars out there, and pick your favorite probability that a star is going to produce light, and you multiply it by the big number of stars, and you're going to end up with some amount of life in the galaxy. The kind of twist on that argument that Drake made is to bring in a factor of the lifetime of a civilization. We have a tendency to think about the idea that once we have intelligent life, they're going to continue on more or less the same, progress, as it were. But certainly in the 60s, if not today, people would worry about us blowing each other up or greenhousing each other to death. So the idea, Drake's kind of interesting twist, was that by measuring the number of communicating civilizations in the galaxy, we could get a handle on what the future lifetime is of our civilization. And you kind of put in reasonable numbers of this, and you're going to get seemingly reasonable numbers for this, and you're going to get a noticeable number of civilizations, assuming that you think that the civilizations are going to last 10,000 years or 100,000 years or a million years or a billion years. All these factors are mostly made up factors. The rate of star formation in the galaxy, we pretty much know what that is. We have a good handle, I would say, starting to get a good handle on the number of habitable planets per star system, and it seems like it's probably not a particularly small number. And from then on in, it's just sort of raw speculation. Questions? Well, let's talk for a second about kind of the big picture, right? So the big picture is, if we go back earlier than this, we've got 13.7 billion years ago. That's when the Big Bang occurred. And the result of the Big Bang was hydrogen and helium, but not the sort of stuff that it takes to make people out of or organisms out of. And remember, that in itself is kind of a surprising feature. Hydrogen is an energy-rich nucleus, one of the most energy-rich nuclei. And why it didn't get burned up in the Big Bang is an interesting question. But it didn't, and so 3 minutes after the Big Bang, what was left was basically hydrogen and helium. So in order to make carbon, oxygen, nitrogen that it's required in order to have life, somehow or other, some of this hydrogen and helium has to be converted into carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen, those sorts of bigger nuclei. The sun isn't doing that. The sun is just burning hydrogen to helium, but it turns out that stars that are more massive than the sun are able to go the next step in fusion. And actually produce these sorts of guys. And then we have to have those stars explode. Right? Because otherwise that stuff is going to just end up in the dead core of a star. So the stars have to synthesize the molecules that are necessary for life, and then they have to explode to spread those out in the universe so that the clouds of gas get polluted with this sort of stuff. And so the next generation of stars can actually have carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen to make living sorts of creatures. And our best guess is that that doesn't take very long. It turns out that the stars that fuse carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen together are relatively short-lived stars. So that, I don't know, certainly 11 billion years or 10 billion years ago, there was a buildup of material that could start to have life. So there's a big gap here between that and 4.5 billion years ago, when we had the formation of the Earth, and a big gap after that to just 0.5 billion years ago, when we had the formation of of multi-celled organisms that might be as simple as a jellyfish. And a huge gap after that to get to, say, 2 million years ago when we started to have moderately intelligent apes walking around. So, at least seemingly, there's no reason that there couldn't be civilizations around that have been around for billions of years, not just a few million years, or in terms of technology, just a few centuries. Okay. So with that kind of as background, I'd like to take kind of a reverse point of view. So we voted, and I think that's as good as any other way of deciding these sorts of issues, because they all are more or less guesses. We voted, and I pretty much agree, at least the median person pretty much agreed, that there probably isn't life beyond Earth in the solar system, although it's such an important question that I would say it's worth pursuing, but the candidates don't look all that good. And in terms of actually looking for it, I would say Mars is our best bet, but basically because if there is life, it might be moderately close to the surface, in contrast to other candidate spots where it might be under 100 kilometers of ice. But beyond that, people were pretty much in agreement that there's probably other life in the galaxy. But there are lots of people who don't think that's the case. So I'd like to try and convince you that that's not the case now. Even though it's pretty much what I think, we want to take a look for a while, at least, at alternative possibilities. And that is that life is really rare, and that these sorts of considerations are wrong, and that even though there are presumably 500 billion planets in our galaxy, none of them, maybe, except ours, has life. So, I don't know, so what are some of these arguments about life being a lot more difficult than we think? And of course, the first thing to realize is that we really can't argue a whole lot based on our own example, right? If we are the one intelligent creature in the galaxy, it doesn't tell us anything, right? The special conditions that are necessary then to have life were evidently present here, but they might not be present other sorts of places. So the first problem is really the incredible difficulty of making life in the first place. It's never happened in a test tube or anything like that. Why do we think that this warm pond that that Darwin talks about would actually work itself out? So you remember we talked about the Miller-Urey experiment, where they took chemicals and put them in a flask and exposed them to sparks and to heat, and they came up with organic chemistry in a relatively short period of time. Is that at all suggestive? Well, remember that they started with methane and ammonia and water. Those turn out to be highly reactive molecules. And we don't really think those molecules were present in the early Earth's atmosphere, right? So if you're going to guess what was present in the Earth's atmosphere, you're going to guess carbon dioxide and nitrogen and water. And those are all very stable molecules. And you remember, in order for a chemical reaction to go, it has to go downhill. Right? So this is the energy, and we're already have pretty much the lowest possible energy in these molecules. And if we're going to build up entropy, it's going to be even less likely. So if you run these experiments with the molecules that we actually think were present in the early atmosphere, you're not going to get complex molecules. So really, the only way to get complex molecules out of this is to have things that are not happening in equilibrium. You know, to have the lightning bolt that suddenly exposes these things to really unusual conditions, and maybe you can spark together some interesting molecules. But they're always going to remain at an incredibly low concentration. It's hard to see how we can start. So you might remember that, you know, kind of among the most famous molecular biologists of the last century were the people who figured out the structure of DNA, Watson and Crick. Crick actually believes that production of life on our planet is not likely. He actually believes that it's so hard to make life, that the chemistry is so incredibly complicated. These sorts of chicken and the egg problems are unsolvable. So he proposes that life actually didn't evolve on this planet, that it had to evolve someplace else, and basically came to the Earth in meteorites. You might remember that we have found interesting organic chemicals in the carbonaceous chondrites. So maybe we have microorganisms that, or the seeds of microorganisms that actually synthesized life, started life here on Earth, and that they may have come from other stars that are billions of years old and had a better shot at producing life. Right? So I've said that life is easy because it started here fast. Maybe it started here fast because it was seeded here, as opposed to it actually evolving here. So there really aren't solutions to this chicken and the egg problem that work out. And the idea that 100 million years is different from 10 years, I don't know, maybe that's a valid argument, maybe not. In any case, smart people like Crick don't buy it. Certainly the majority of biologists buy it, but Crick at least doesn't buy it. Let's take a look at this Drake equation argument, which I think is maybe the most interesting argument, which is basically, of course, that there's zillions of stars. And we've multiplied together a lot of factors, which we figure out are, you know, of order one, in order to get our final answer. But that kind of implies that we know what those factors are that are important for life. So to pick a random example, one thing that is very unusual about the Earth is it's got a big moon, right? No other terrestrial planet has a big moon like the Earth has. Is the existence of a big moon required for life? You say no, but let me make the following argument, at least for life on land. If you don't have a big moon, then you're not going to have tides, and so you're going to have a very sharp distinction between the land and the air, and the sea. Only when you have tides are you going to have this sort of intermediate region where you have a chance to kind of to live in a bit of both worlds and then maybe get good at living on land. So maybe we need a big moon. In order to get us, it sure looks like it was necessary to kill off those dinosaurs. Right? The dinosaurs were champions of the Earth 65 million years ago, and then asteroid came along and killed them all. Or not them all, lots of them. Was that necessary? Would, absent that asteroid, would the dinosaurs have been just, you know, kind of dumb herd creatures taking over the Earth? Was it a series of really lucky accidents that led to mammals coming into existence? If you look at the sun, pretty commonly people say that the sun is a typical star, but it's not really a typical star. It's kind of on the edge. It is a typical star would have a much lower surface temperature and a much smaller size. There would still be a habitable zone around such a star. But the sun is really a little bit unusual. Do you need a star just like the sun in order to have life? If it's a little bit bigger, if it's actually just slightly bigger than the sun, then it's all going to be over in about a billion years. And I think it's pretty likely that we're not going to get intelligent life under those circumstances. So the real question is it possible to have life on stars that are typical and hence have a smaller mass than the sun? So in any case, you can start to put together zillions of little factors that are special about the Earth. And those special factors, you can argue, seem to play an important role in the history of life on the planet. And as I start to put more and more and more factors into the Drake equation, the results are going to get smaller and smaller and smaller. So I commented about the moon. Clearly, we're the only terrestrial planet that has a moon, and the way we think the moon formed is really special, right? Had to have this special collision. Maybe only one in a million planets have that sort of situation. So as you start to put together more and more of these factors, you start to get a smaller and smaller number of communicating civilizations. So the last argument I want to put forward is due to Fermi. And what Fermi said is, where are they? And in essence, the argument is going to be, if there are intelligent creatures in our galaxy, they would already be here already. And kind of the basis of Fermi's argument is to realize that what we're talking about, you know, is times that are on the order of 10 billion years. There's no, as far as we can figure out, if you believe the Drake equation, there's no reason that civilizations could have evolved 10 billion years ago. And so if it's like the Earth, after a million years or so, they would have taken over their planet the way we've taken over our planet and headed off into space. Now, it's hugely distant between stars. It's kind of unimaginable that that you could reach stars in a time frame that's shorter than about 1,000 years. But there are 10 million 1,000-year cycles in 10 billion years. So if you think about one star 10 billion years ago producing life that then spreads out, and 2 million years after they established that planet, they spread out again, you calculate how long it takes to populate the galaxy. It's not that long. So it's hugely difficult to travel between stars. And I do very much believe that warp drive isn't going to happen. It is going to always take huge amounts of time to go between stars. You got ultra huge times available. You've got 10 billion years to populate to fill the galaxy with your progeny. So, I don't know, maybe people don't like to leave home, so they just stick around. Finding a way to freeze yourself or send some sort of robot out to another planet to populate it there is all maybe difficult, but as I say, Fermi's question is, where are they? If they've got 10 billion years to populate the galaxy, the first guy out is going to win. All the habitable space is going to be taken up. And we haven't, as I say, we've investigated, I don't know if I want to say moderately carefully or not. So we talked about SETI, right? The search for extraterrestrial life. This 1,000 years is going to keep us, obviously in our lifetimes, from ever sending any spacecraft to visit other stars. So the only information we're going to have from other stars is going to be light. And we talked about what I think is going to be the way we're going to discover life out in the galaxy in a decade or so is based on looking at planets that are eclipsing their stars. And so we get a little bit of light that has gone through their atmosphere, and it's going to show, for example, oxygen, which as far as we can figure out is not a natural product. It requires some sort of life. So the SETI people take the other sort of point of view, right? That there are people broadcasting, and something like the nearest 1,000, 10,000 stars have been investigated by those guys, and they find nobody around. It's hard to see why there is any civilization much like the Earth's within on the order of 100 light years of the Earth. Questions? I think if there are no questions, as good a place as any to quit. Quit early once for a while. So, in terms of the final, kind of the usual things apply. If you should find, of course, your own exams and the answers to those exams in some sort of webcast. But I really encourage you to bring in your own answers, bring them into my office, and let me look them over to see if we can agree on what the right answer is to these various questions. A couple of times for the final, take the post-test.
It really seems as though it can't be life out there if we haven't found it yet, because of what that's saying.
So, So right now we're just talking about the galaxy. I think it's dead obvious that there has to be life someplace in the universe. But in our galaxy, Fermi would argue, maybe not. So it's hugely distant to nearby galaxies. So I think Fermi's argument of populating the universe from some seed galaxy doesn't work out. But in our galaxy itself, maybe.
Crazy.